from that in just a few moments. You know, sometimes you can come to church and things may have happened that week that troubled you, and you can't quite figure out what's going on. But then you come to church and it all becomes clear. Earlier this week, I was in a beautiful wooded area in Decula just relaxing, and I got hit with three rocks. And I... And it all makes sense now. We're wrapping up our series on worship today. And I've really enjoyed it. And I think it's spurred a lot of great conversations I've had with many of you. This is the seventh week. We started looking at Revelation 4, this great scene of worship. John says, I looked and I saw an open door. And it was an invitation from God to come and see what was inside this open door. And there was God, the vision of God on the throne. And we talked about worship as being a response to God. And that worship is this outpouring of joy and amazement and gratitude and celebration that in a sense you can't teach. Because it's not something you plan and you schedule. It's just a response to what you see when you see God. We talked about worship requiring surrender. Trusting that God is good. That God's intentions for us are good so that you're drawn to God. We talked about needing to overcome fear and distraction and the overstimulation that we all experience. In our world. And those things just tend to numb and paralyze us so that we don't engage with God in a meaningful way. We talked about how worship is not just a Sunday morning thing or a thing that we plan when we gather, but worship is moment by moment. Learning to see God around us, learning to identify those God moments that I believe are all around us, but we can all too often miss. Talked about the need to be still and know that God is God, to open up, to pay attention. We talked about that when we declare God's goodness, it helps us to believe and remember how good God is. And that sometimes we experience life or come into worship services not feeling like worshiping. But sometimes there's something about, we read in Psalm 103, that starts, bless the Lord, O my soul. That we can talk to our inner beings and telling ourselves in our inmost place to bless the Lord, to praise the Lord, to worship the Lord. And sometimes engaging in that way helps us to really remember how good God is and that God is worthy of praise. We've talked about worship being about sacrifice and not about our own sufficiency. And that worship is an offering and not an obligation. And in this last sermon today, I want to say one more thing about worship. But I want to take a moment here to talk about worship services, which I think we're all understanding is a different thing. Now, it's not that it's not included in worship, but worship services are just one part of a lifestyle of worship. But I just wanted to pause for a moment and say thank you to all that you do to make our worship services more meaningful and engaging. I believe we're getting better. I believe we're growing. And we're kind of in a transition right now. Now, a lot of the musicians that have led worship for us have, many of them have graduated and gone to Athens, which I'm not bitter about that or anything. You know, three of them left my household to go out there. But I believe our worship services are getting better. I believe they're more, for me, they're more engaging. And I wanted to thank all all of you for the way that I believe we as a body are opening ourselves up to God and to an encounter with God. But I also don't want to let this time pass without thanking Josh Holt, because he has done a great job over the last few years, really. He takes on the lion's share of planning our worship services. We talk about it at least every week in staff meeting, but Josh is the one making it happen. And I just wanted to thank him and let you know how grateful I am to have him working alongside me. I really appreciate him. You know, it's a challenge to plan services for any group that's diverse in any way. It's not hard to find churches all around here that are all people in their 70s and 80s. Really, it's not. It's also not hard to find churches that are all young people. It's not hard to find churches that are completely one race or one ethnic group. But when you have a mix of any kind, it's hard to plan services that engage everyone. And so that's one of the challenges that that Josh and we as a staff wrestle with every week. Partly we do songs that are what our musicians and singers can do. Just very practical, right? You know, there is something about gospel music that moves me like little else. And if you've noticed who gets up here on the stage, not a super gospel-y bunch. That doesn't mean I'm not praying for a gospel-y bunch. But basically, one of our limiting factors is we do music that we feel like we can do and do as well as we can. But there's something else going on, and you've probably noticed that this, is that we have kind of tipped the scales toward the younger end of things. And this is not just personal preference. This is just what David likes or what Josh likes. I wanted to talk a little bit about a part of why we do what we do. And that is, if you've looked around very much, one thing you will notice is that we don't have very many people in the, like, 20-somethings. Or, like, we jump from high school seniors who graduate and leave and don't come back to mid-30s with 6 kids. And there's this big gap, and but we've strategically, I want us to plan services that will appeal to a demographic that we actually don't have. You say, well, that's kind of dumb. You know, you want to make everybody that you already have mad? Just so you can appeal to people you don't have. I believe, I want us to have this whole, the full span of this demographic range. I think it's healthy, and I think it's good. I think there's an energy that group that we're missing brings. And I want, if those people come in, I don't want them to say, this is definitely not the church for me. You know, I'm 54 years old. The kind of music we do now, I'm 54 years old and grew up in the Church of Christ. You know, the way I grew up, everybody up here playing an instrument was in sin. You can say, well, what about the Christian churches? Their doctrine is almost identical. They just have pianos and organs. Are they your brothers and sisters? Well, yes, but they are brethren in error. And I think we've figured out along the way that if you can't fellowship with brethren in error, You can't fellowship because that's the only kind you got. You just have to pick your error. But we all have what we grew up with and what we're used to. I grew up in a church, but also I grew up in a family, you know, I'm the eighth of nine kids, and we had a family that loved to sing, and we sang church songs all the time. By the time I was in high school, I probably knew 400 or 500 hymns and knew all four parts to them. And I love that music. Guess what? My kids don't love that music. If we did that all the time, they wouldn't come to church here. Well, they're just immature. Yeah, they are. Here's the way I look at it. For the better part of a decade, I have been immersed in the music that my sons love while I've been teaching them to play guitar. Because my interest for them is not that they play my songs on guitar. My interest is that they learn guitar and enjoy music for the rest of their lives. And if I insisted that they played music from a completely different generation, they never would have taken up guitar. But I'd say, listen, there's some awesome songs by Perry Como and Neil Diamond and, you know, and I've just alienated all the Perry Como and Neil Diamond fans in here. But they, you know, both of you. But but again, you know, in engaging. And the thing is, as a father, because I wanted them to learn to love music and to love it and enjoy it for the rest of their lives, I could set aside my preference and my desire in order to help them engage. And when it comes to church music, I've had music the way I wanted it for 50 years. I have a foundation of faith, and I'm not going anywhere. But see, I don't necessarily just love to see, you know, love music that I prefer most. What I love to see teens worshiping. And I love to be engaged in helping young people engage with God and enjoy their relationship with God for the rest of their lives. And if it means setting aside my preference and what I grew up with, I will gladly do that. Now, we also want to try to engage everyone without alienating anybody. And we get feedback from time to time about something that bothers somebody or that they just don't prefer or that I'd like to see more of this. And I just want everybody to know we encourage that kind of feedback. And we appreciate people who take time to share deeply from their hearts about what moves them, what they like. But we don't do everything everybody says, because we can't. But we still want to hear from you, and it matters to us. And we'll do everything we can to engage everyone. But we believe it reflects the heart of God to try to engage people who are not already engaged. And that means it's more than just music, and it's more than just appealing to young people. Another aspect of this same thing is I try really hard not to use insider language. You know what I mean? Some of you may not know what I mean because it's hard to identify insider language if you're an insider. Because it just seems like normal language. But sometimes as followers of Jesus and members of a particular church culture, we can talk in ways, and we use these little phrases. And we talk about the way we use disciples or the brothers or the this or the that, and somebody who's visiting goes, who are you talking about? And so I very intentionally try not to use insider language, and it's an intentional effort not to alienate people who are not already engaged with God. Isaiah talks about the mountains being lowered and the valleys filled in and a level path being made to God. That's our job, people. And so we want everyone to have a meaningful experience, but we do tip the table toward those who are not already fully engaged with God. And so that's part of the intentionality of what we're doing. So that's enough about worship services. Now let's talk about worship. To close out this series on worship, I want to talk about what I believe is the most important factor in our worship, and that is our view of God. We've talked about worship not being a Sunday morning thing or a planned event that we go to, but a way of life. And really, it has to do with us seeing God and then responding to God. We talked about, really, ideally, God's vision for us is that everything we do begins as an encounter with God. And if that's true, then one of the most important questions you can ask is, when you hear the word God, what comes to your mind? Because according to Jesus, if you have an incorrect view of God, it can really mess things up. In Luke chapter 15, Jesus tells some stories, and what's going on here is that Jesus was being criticized for hanging out with all the wrong kinds of people. And Jesus apparently thought, see, now you're criticizing me, but your real problem is you don't understand my Father in heaven. Because if you really understood God, you wouldn't be criticizing me for hanging out with all the wrong kinds of people. So Jesus goes on to tell three stories. He tells a story about a man who had 100 sheep, and one of them was lost. And then he tells another story about a woman who had 10 coins, and one of them was lost. And then he tells a story about a man who had 2 sons, and one of them was lost. And all three of these stories are illustrations of who God is. This was Jesus' answer to people saying, you hang out with the wrong kind of people. And Jesus said, listen, you need to understand. If you knew God, you would see that he tips everything toward those who are lost. Because God is the man who had 100 sheep and one of them was lost, and he left the 99 and went to seek the one. God is a woman on her knees, scrubbing the house, looking under the beds, looking everywhere, desperately for the one of the 10 coins that was lost. He says, that's who God is. God is a father, waiting on the front porch, waiting in the driveway. I don't know if they had driveways back then. But he's waiting. And God is also the God who went out to the field to talk to the older son. I think most of us are more familiar with the story of the younger son. A lot of times this story is called the parable of the prodigal son, which means the wasteful son. And that's the younger one. But this story ends in a really poignant and meaningful interaction between the father and the older son. And we're going to focus more on that today. But before we read there, I want to tell you a story I heard. I heard this a couple years ago. I was a part of a meeting of ministers from all kinds of different churches around Gwinnett County. And I was at this lunch, and I was talking to a preacher, and he told me the story. And I think this is true, even though it came from a preacher. It was about this. There was a teenager. And this teenager was drunk, and he was out with his friends, and all his friends in the car were drunk. And this guy crashed the car. And so this young man had the dreaded task before him to call his dad from jail. His dad comes and gets him later on at home that night, kind of in the middle of the night, in his dad's study. This teen boy is weeping over what he's done. And the dad says one thing and one thing only. The son's pouring out all the dumb choices he made and how he wished he hadn't done it. The father only said one thing, and it was this. How about tomorrow we go and get you a new car? And this preacher went on to say, I like to tell that story, but every time I do, people in my church get mad. So if you're mad right now, you're busted. No. If you're mad right now, that's probably pretty normal. Because here's the deal. Our thinking can get twisted here. Because when we think of ourselves, we always want grace and not judgment. But when we think about the world, grace is scandalous. I can say if you're a father, you're probably thinking about what was this father thinking? What a perfect opportunity to learn responsibility and consequences and, you know, a good chance to say, I'll never have to buy you a car again. You got to earn your own. Or, you know, whatever. Because we like grace when it's coming our way. But what about the business partner that leaves your company and takes half your clients with him? God, just shower him with grace. And we can come up with all kinds of illustrations there where we really don't think grace is appropriate. And one of those might be a son who takes half of his father's assets and goes off and wastes them. That's what prodigal means, is wasteful. But this wasteful son comes to his senses in the pig pen. In verse 17 of Luke 15, he says, how many of my father's hired men have food to spare, and here I am starving to death. I'll set out and go back to my father and say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired men. So he got up and went to his father. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and was filled with his compassion for him. He ran to his son, threw his arms around him, and kissed him. The son said to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. But the father said to his servants, Quick, bring the best robe and put it on him. Put a ring on his finger and sandals on his feet. Bring the fattened calf and kill it. Let's have a feast and celebrate. For this son of mine was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found. So they began to celebrate. You know, when somebody royally messes up, we believe they need to spend some time in the penalty box. Whether you know what hockey is or not. You know, not many of us know hockey. We all have penalty boxes, right? If somebody messes up, they need to do some time being alienated. They need to spend some time being held at arm's length. They need some time to think about what they've done. And I want to ask you, it says the father, the guy, he has this beautiful speech. I've sinned against heaven and against you. I don't deserve to be. And it's like the father said, shut up. Bring a ring. Bring a robe. Kill the fattened calf. That's a lot of beef. That's about 800 pounds of barbecue. He said this was a big celebration. Big. He didn't say, run to Kroger and grab a rotisserie chicken. That's mom and dad and the two sons, you know, if mom and dad aren't hungry. He said, kill the fattened calf. For the son of mine was lost, and now he's found. Let me ask you, and then he throws a party, and he has a dance. I love it. Let me ask you this. How long do you think it was before the son and the father have this encounter until when the son is on the dance floor, busting a move? A few hours at the most. It was that same day. Apparently it was still light because it's when people were coming in out of the fields toward the end of the day, like in evening. And the party's going on. The father did not put the son in the penalty box. He didn't hold him at arm's length until he could learn his lesson. And Jesus is saying, listen, those of you who think I'm hanging out with all the wrong kinds of people, it's because you don't know who God is. You think I ought to be holding all these wrong people at arm's length. But it's simply because you don't know who God is. Verse 25. Meanwhile, the older son was in the field. When he came near the house, he heard music and dancing. He heard music and dancing. If you're dancing hard enough that people can hear it, that's some dancing right there. I don't mean to brag, but I'm a very good dancer. But from all the way out in the field, he heard music and dancing. And what does the older son do? I want to talk about what he doesn't do. He doesn't say, Dad's throwing a party. I remember in the almost 15 years that Sue and I lived in Michigan, those trips home, I really hate driving. I like arriving. But my idea of a good vacation is not to drive cross country. Some of you love that. I hate that. Part of it's cars don't necessarily fit me very well. But I don't like to drive, but the closer we would get to Chattanooga, I mean, by the time we got off of the interstate and we're going down Tonal Boulevard headed toward Acuff Street, where that little house that I grew up in, the closer I got, the more I was about to come out of my skin. I couldn't wait to be with my family because when we came home, the whole family would get together and it was a celebration. And I couldn't wait to be there. It hits me so hard how that's not what this guy was experiencing. He was not saying, whoa, music and dancing, Dad's throwing one of his parties, I'm there. He heard it, and he turned aside to one of his servants and said, what's going on over there? I hear him say, what's the old man up to now? And he said, well, your younger brother has come home. And then he really, you know, hit the fan. But he was already reserved and aloof before he even knew his younger brother was involved. has come, and your father has killed the fattened calf because he has him back safe and sound. The older brother became angry and refused to go in. So his father went out and pleaded with him. But he answered his father, "Look, all these years I've been slaving for you and never disobeyed your orders. Yet you never gave me even a young goat so I could celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours, who has squandered your property with prostitutes, comes home, you kill the fattened calf for him." "My son," the father said, "you are always with me, and everything I have is yours. But we had to celebrate and be glad because this brother of yours was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found." The older brother heard music and dancing, and instead of running to join in the celebration along with his father, he turned aside. He asked what was going on. He found his younger brother, who didn't deserve grace, was involved, and he made the decision right then and there, I'm not going to have any part with that. And what does the father do? "You arrogant, self-righteous son, what do you think you're doing?" Nope, that's not what the father did. The father responded to his brokenness exactly the same way he responded to the younger son's brokenness. The father went out and found him, and he pleaded with him. "Son, all that I have is yours. You've been with me all along." And the son says, "You're right, I've been with you all along. I've worked like a slave for you all these years." It's interesting. The younger one says, "I don't deserve to be a son. All I want to do is just go back and be a slave." The son, who had been diligent and disciplined and always showed up, viewed his life with the father as slavery. He was responsible and hardworking, and he always showed up every day, and he didn't trust the father. He didn't run to be with the father. He was always with the father, and he was nothing like the father. A part of worship, not just worship services, but worship moment by moment, is opening yourself up to God, seeking God with all your heart, reaching out, straining toward God with every fiber of your being. But if you don't believe God is good, why in the world would you do that? So at the end of the story, there's a celebration going on. Music and dancing that you can hear far away. Celebration. 800 pounds of barbecued beef. And the older son is outside, refusing to come in. Jesus wanted people to understand who God was, so he told a story about a man who had 100 sheep and one of them was lost. And he told a story about a woman who had 10 coins and one of them was lost. And he told a story about a man who had 2 sons and one of them was lost. And at the end of the story, it's the older son who's lost. See, because sometimes we can get lost in the world, and other times we can just get lost at church. We show up. We're hardworking. But the way we feel about it is that we've been slaving away all these years. And we may come across as arrogant and self-righteous, but I don't really believe that's the root problem here. I believe because of the way the father pleads with this older son, he said, listen, everything I have is yours. You've had everything. If you just told me what you wanted, it would have been yours. He says, I've slaved away for you all these years, and you never gave me this, and you never gave me that. You never gave me a young goat to have a party with my friends. But what did I do? I showed up. I worked hard. I slaved away. I did all this stuff for you. It sounds to me like the way this guy felt, the way this son felt about the way he showed up and was dependable and hardworking, was because that's the way he thought he had value. I don't think the problem was arrogance and self-righteousness. I think it was self-rejection. I don't think I'm worth anything unless I slave away. And the father said, listen, I don't love you because of what you produce. I love you because you're mine. When we think of lostness, I think we generally think of lostness in the world. But I hope this turns our hearts toward the fact that we can get lost at church. People who always show up, who work hard, who are diligent and disciplined, can mess up because they just don't understand who God is. And in this story, God is the God waiting on the front porch for the younger son who was prodigal, who was wasteful. He's also the father who immediately ran to the field when he heard the older son wasn't going to come to the party. This older son, and we don't know whether he accepted it or not, but he got some good news here. This older son received gospel. And the gospel that this older son received was, if you just stop being arrogant and self-righteous, you can be included. The gospel he received which you don't have anything to prove. You don't need to justify your existence by all that you produce. You're already in. You're my son. I don't love you because you're perfect, because you're not. I don't love you for what you produce, because I got servants all over the place around here that can work for me. I love you because you're mine. It's a scary thing for your kids to leave home. We got three boys in college. And if their college experience is anything like mine, they're going to have some really great times. And they're also going to really struggle because it's hard to grow up. They're probably in the next few years going to experience some of the darkest times they've ever experienced so far in their short lives. And when they go through those times, I hope they understand above all else that Sue and I don't love them because they're perfect. We love them because they're ours. to all kinds of crazy behaviors. Jesus says, it's like Jesus gave these people who are criticizing and condemning him for hanging out with the wrong people, it's like Jesus even gives them the benefit of the doubt and says, oh, you know what the problem is? You know, I don't take this personally. You just don't understand who God is. Let me explain it to you. That's pretty cool. You see, here's the deal. If when you hear God, you don't picture a good God, you won't run to God. And if you don't run to God, if you don't see a God that's worthy of worship, you won't worship. And that will show up on Sunday mornings when you come in. If you don't feel there's a good God that deserves to be worshipped, that affects how you behave in worship services. But I'm more concerned that it will affect how you behave in what is supposed to be moment by moment, day by day worship, in recognizing the good God that's all around us. Loving and adoring and worshiping the good God that says you don't have anything to prove. You don't have to justify your existence. You're mine. Let's pray.